Welcome back to the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of book and reading. Today's Thursday, May 12th, 2022. I'm Jeff O'Neill, here with Rebecca Shinsky, coming to you from bookriot.com. It's Pulitzer Day. Pulitzer Prize were announced this week. That'll be our main topic. I guess this is, I don't know if this is a good segue or not, but as a heads up on the Pulitzer tip, I think Sea of Tranquility, I guess we're going to do most of our discussion, all of our discussion for the Patreon feed, the Wheelhouse, that's going to drop
yes,
next
indeed.
Week. But could you say now, do you think it's reasonable to consider Sea of Tranquility in the mix for the Pulitzer or NBA or you know end of year awards? We haven't talked about it all together, so this can be our tease. You think it is
yes.
or is not at this moment in the ring?
I will be very surprised if we get to fall or early next year and are not hearing about, I guess it'll be early yeah. next year, and are not hearing about Sea of Tranquility being a finalist for Pulitzer National Book Award, any of those kinds of big conversations.
The Pulitzer is the strangest of them in this regard, which it's a committee within a committee.
Yeah.
And so you can get some strange choices. And today, I don't know if it's strange, but it's not what I would have expected, though we can talk a little bit more about 2021 not having a lot of likely Larrys. I don't, that phrase has infiltrated my speech of late. I don't know
where it comes from.
I don't know. Was I listening to like old timey radio? I don't know what that is.
I heard you say it a couple weeks ago on a call and I was like, huh, that's new.
Is that even a thing?
I don't
is that
think
even
it
a
is.
Thing? I don't know.
Did you just invent the likely Larry?
An dialect of one, an idiolect is what they call it. A speech made up for idiots by themselves. But I didn't have a whole lot of shocks, can you believe it stuff, but I would say the same that, again, sometimes the front runners don't necessarily make it for the reason because they're front runners, but it's the quality of book, and it does some book winner things, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, we call it Oscar bait a little bit
yes.
in the movie world, and I don't think quite the same thing happens because there's so many books and it's too random, but it has award bait written all over it. And I don't mean that dismissively. I really don't mean that, but it does, it ticks a lot of the boxes.
I think so.
A little bit. So you can check that out. It's going to be on the feed next week. We've been doing about once a week of additional audio content. We're going to try to keep that up for a while. We might take a break here and there, or maybe there's some other kind of poll or blog post or something else going. But a good reaction to the Florence Williams stuff so far. I hope everyone enjoyed that. We didn't get any ideas for who else to do, which maybe is resonating with our sense of this is a
singular.
One-off kind of unique, singular situation where the process, the book, the experience, and then Pushkin itself was willing to play along with Florence, of course, herself, too.
I think that's right. That's a very special audiobook, and there will be other special, interesting audiobooks in the future, but I think they're uncommon, and that's what makes them special.
It is.
Yeah. And usually, so if you're just listening to this and you're like, what is the Patreon? What is the Wheelhouse?
Oh, right. Yeah. There you go.
We do ad-free early releases of this show. If you're listening in the regular feed, you're probably listening on Monday morning. That's when it's normally released. So Patreon members, we're calling our Patreon the Wheelhouse. For idiosyncratic shared language reasons. What's an idiolect of two, Jeff?
A duolect.
They're okay, yes. For dualectical reasons.
I just made that up.
Great.
Don't
I'm going
email
with
me.
It.
I made
different
that up. Don't
than,
email me.
Different than dialectical. Mm-hmm. So everybody gets access, early ad-free access to these shows at all of the levels of Wheelhouse membership. And then at a couple of the levels, you also get access to the bonus content. So the early regular episodes are coming out in the Patreon feed on Fridays. And then the bonus content comes out in that feed on Tuesdays as we're going. And there is something new just about so far every week, probably in the fullness of time, it'll be just about every week. But we've got interesting things planned for every week through the next couple of months, and you know, no shortage of ideas here. We've been doing this for 500 plus episodes, and we've got plenty more to go.
Yeah, we did a little content planning yesterday. It's been a wild week here. And I can't remember if it was yesterday or not, but we had one idea that was, we kind of came at the same sort of thing from two different angles, but we landed on, I think, a non-standard content block that I'm as excited for as I've ever been for something we're going to do. And you know what I'm talking about.
I do. And to continue the vagary about it,
yes.
I looked at the link that you had sent me about this secret thing this morning and just like, holy crap, there's so much to talk about.
Yeah. Well, this won't be a spoiler, but we were thinking like, let's look back at some year. We had a really good time And I thought it was really interesting when we did the 10 years of Book Riot look back with Amanda for this show. That was like, let's just talk about the books that have mattered over the last 10 years. And I thought that was really interesting and fun to do. And we got good feedback that, you know, that's not something you're going to hear on very many shows, especially. It's even strange for ours. And so we found a year that made our, you know, kind of made our eyes into manga eyes of desire, you know, the big watery, you know, quivering eyes where like, this is the year to do. And so
manga eyes
we're going
to
do that.
Has to be the show title.
It's pretty good, right? And so that's one where we're going to try around with some, that's a new format. We're going to bring back some of our other familiar, but unfrequent formats too. So check it out. Thank you all so much who have signed up already. It's really been great for us to see all that happening. We're going to continue to pump that out here and stuff on the show. We're going to do our first break and get into the news.
Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle. Walk, Ride, Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness, but it is also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. And Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk, Ride, Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold on April 9th. It is narrated and written by Tim Kaine, Virginia senator and former Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's a compelling account of one man's journey across hundreds of miles of Virginia wilderness and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. So make sure to check out Walk, Ride, Paddle by Tim Kaine. And thanks again to Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle, for sponsoring this episode.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
I want to save Pulitzer's for just a minute. It's been a while since I dropped a "Is this a thing?" Link. Did you take a look at this? It was early this morning.
Just
take a look at this thing.
Yes, I did take a little bit of a look. I didn't do a deep dive into the piece.
That's fine.
Here, but I think I got enough of a look to have a take because this is podcasting. So
okay. So wait, hold on the take. Yeah, hold the take. I'll give the overview here.
Yeah, set us up.
There's this company called Remarkable. Lowercase r, uppercase m, I don't know, people do things, that has sold 1 million devices since 2017 and raised money at a valuation of $1 billion. So what this thing is a minimalist, they call it unusual, this is in Mac Rumors, the piece is by Hartley Charlton, put a link in the show notes here, there's a video where you can see a walkthrough, a minimalist reading and writing focused tablet. So it's been a while since we talked about hardware, and I saw this. And I'd seen this before, and I've always like, oh, that's interesting, and maybe I would be interested, except not, because I always think that some experience other than just reading on a tablet is what I'm going to do, like I'm going to buy a stylus and do everything else. But this, again, it's not just a proof of concept. It's not just some strange thing that's being produced and not sold, and you only get it for $2,000 of your artist. A million is a lot of devices. Now, again, it's over the last 5 years. But $1 billion, they've raised money, and they're growing. And it is the kind of thing that's different enough from what I have called the gold standard of digital reading, which is basically, I would say, an iPad Air or an iPad Mini, depending on whether or not you're reading comics or something like that. But it's a full color, very good, interoperable. You can get a whole bunch of apps and very easy to use. And it's a robust ecosystem, good quality screen, so on and so forth. This is a little bit different. It's e-ink, so it's black and white, right? But it does the thing where you can get a stylus and annotate and draw and read. It supports a bunch of the EPUB stuff. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about before that print is still the best if you want to write stuff on your book, right? It just is. And there's some stuff you can do, hacks to be able to annotate or underline on Kindles, at least, where you double click and hold and whatever, and it goes into your file. But there's nothing that quite has yet replicated the feeling, almost the cliche of sitting down with a textbook and underlining, highlighting, double exclamation point, and then dog-earing everything else so you can remember and add some metatextual information to what you've been reading. This one looks pretty good. People seem to be buying this. So in the great tradition of David Letterman's, is this something or is this nothing? Rebecca Shinsky, I will throw it to you. Is this something or nothing?
I think it's nothing.
God damn it. Yeah,
I think it's it's not a total nothing. Like, as you were saying, a million devices is not nothing. But a million devices over 5 years. I didn't even bother to Google how many iPads Apple has sold, but it's
exponentially
ridiculous. More than that. They're on the ninth generation of iPads. It's noted in this piece. I think this is nothing because it's really unclear who this is for. Like, my sense of the e-read, like people's desires from e-reading and sort of where we've landed, is that we're far enough out of the initial ebook panic that you and I saw like in the early days of Book Riot around, like, is this going to erode all reading and will it erode the sales of print books and whatever, that folks who want to annotate the books that they're reading probably mostly do the thing that you and I do of, like, we read some things digitally, the things we want to write on or hold in our hands, we just buy the hardcover or the paperback and hold it in our hands. This looks to me mostly like it's for that. It's not about the reading so much as the writing. Like, I think this could be positioned in an interesting way for a customer that wants to take a lot of handwritten notes but have them stored digitally without having to, like, scan things in and out. Or, I mean, I don't know. I'm sure there are apps that do this. For all, I haven't touched Evernote in a million years, but, like, for all I know, Evernote could do this on an iPad with a stylus. I would not be surprised. But this looks like it's for that, and they seem to be really leaning on the distraction-free elements of it, that, like, you're not going to get a bunch of alerts because you won't have a bunch of apps on it. You could focus on the thing that you're writing or that project that you're outlining or whatever. Maybe creative types that want to be, like, I don't know, storyboarding or doing some sort of planning thing that you would like to have digital records of rather than just put it on a legal pad. This seems like it would kind of work for that, but I don't know that it's that the distraction-free element of it. I'm making air quotes that you can't see because this is a visual medium, podcasting. That I just don't know that that's a powerful enough or compelling enough proposition to make someone spend their money on this device instead of an iPad when this device is only $30 less. And
it's a great point.
Yeah, I just don't know. I feel like it's a little late. Maybe this would have been something if it were coming out in 2014. I don't know. I think there will be something that disrupts some segment of iPad users or maybe captures people who just, for whatever reason, don't want an Apple device or have a use. But, like, well, now that I'm talking myself out of it, like, who has a use for e-reading and digital note-taking but doesn't have a use for the other things an iPad can do? I don't know. Tell me about your reaction to my take, because that was interesting.
Well, I think you're right. I'm kind of hoping, I like new stuff. I like new shiny things, and I'm interested in disruption of the status quo is too jargony, but I like to see what else is out there and possibilities. And I like reading on my phone and iPad digital books, but the annotation experience stinks. But I realized after reading this and thinking about it, and I wondered if you're going to get the same point, you sort of did, is how many people really do it,
right?
How much do I really do it? And it's not enough to get into a whole new ecosystem with all its limitations. And let's take our Sea of Tranquility discussion. Even if I wanted to annotate it, and even if I got the Remarkable 2, I can't mark up a Mobi from Amazon or Apple, because you can't mess with that file. That's what DRM is about. And I understand, blah, blah, blah. This is if you have PDFs that aren't DRM'd, and then you could actually mark up the file and send it back. So I think if you are someone who's dealing with documents, presentations, text a lot internally, like your own organization or whatever is creating a lot of documents, and it still is the case, and we find this with our own company, it's still hard to give accurate notes on visual things, mm-hmm. right? You're like talking about it. So I can see a use case this. And if you look at the little video, it's very slickly done video. And I want to work for these companies and these places, wherever they make these things, where it's always like dusk and the coffee's always warm and you're writing on leather desks and everyone's shirts are pressed and they all have full heads of hair and everyone looks like they're well compensated and rested. But it's like, I don't do this. I'm not marking up a bar graph for a investor presentation for my designer that'll go do it, right? It's just not how I was doing it. And then here's the other thing. The other thing about the physical book that you write in, only part of it is that you wrote in it. The other thing is that it's easy to flip through and see where your notes are.
Yeah. And I think that's a huge part of it. Like, as I was prepping, I read Sea of Tranquility in hardcover because we were going to talk about
so
it.
So did I.
I underlined and made notes in the book. And then as I prepped, that's exactly what I did. I went and flipped back through. What did I underline? Of those things, what's still important? How do these pieces all come together? Like, I think where I'm really stuck is if you have a company that does that kind of work, where you need to review documents or you need to mark up a visual thing.
Yeah.
You can do that. You can do it on iPads.
That's a great point.
You can do it on the Google Whiteboard situation. I think Zoom has a tool for it. I'm sure that there's a thing. You could even do this on Slack and that I just don't know what that is because we don't use those things. But I think especially after the last 2.5 years where collaborating virtually has become essential to really any kind of knowledge work, I would bet money that Microsoft Teams has a version of this. You know, most of the big platforms have ways to facilitate that kind of work already. So like, what's the reason that a company would go buy these devices instead of buying iPads? That $30 price difference is not, like, if you're in the spot where the $30 price difference between a Remarkable 2 and an iPad is going to be a make or break decision for the things you're buying for your staff, you have problems other than which device to buy for your staff. So I just feel like it's interesting. It feels late. This feels very late to me that if it had been an early alternative available to people who wanted to do these kinds of like the black and white e-ink, try to mark up a thing, PDF, like maybe, I don't know, attorneys, who needs to mark things? I don't even know, Jeff, who needs to mark things up?
Oh yeah, attorneys, I mean, text editors, you know, a lot of people that are, you know, documentation, there's a lot of use cases for it. But even the Norwegian CEO here says, we're positioning this in a third place, right? We see that the tablet is becoming a hybrid of the notebook and the phone. I think that makes sense.
Yes.
We're doing this other thing focused on notes, books, and drawing. And I guess it speaks so well of the adoption of tablets that there's space for a weird bespoke device like this. Because, you know, it's like, do people drive smart cars around Richmond at all? Do you see smart cars around?
Are those the ones that look like Legos?
Kind like of, yes. Tiny? They're little tiny guys that I could never fit in a million years, right?
Yes. I mean, a couple. I see a few. It's not super popular.
Well, again, that's a few. So the car market is so big that there's room for like little strange niches that is weird and stupid and not a good value proposition for some people. But some people might just want something different enough that you can sell a million of them over 5 years, because there are billions of iPads out there. And if you think of a phone and iPad as more an iPhone and iPad, or a Kindle as more of a continuum, there are tens of billions of devices. Not tens of billions is probably a lot, but billions of devices out there that are in this space, which means there's room for the weirdo mushroom that only grows under this one kind of tree at this particular latitude and longitude, right? Like the ecosystem is so big and diverse that there's a niche, and there's a niche for this, which means that it's probably nothing. But we hadn't one word to talk about.
It's an outlier. That's what, you know, and that does speak to, I think, a certain maturity of the market that you're getting at. That it's big enough that there's not just one or two things, but that there can be outliers. But definitionally, outliers are not things.
Right. By definite outliers are not things. Yeah. Just because pens are great and some people like fountain pens doesn't mean fountain pens are a thing.
Right.
Necessarily. They're just, they're a strange idiolective usage. No, really, that's what came up today. It's a useful use for us. But I hadn't seen something like this. I thought some people might be interested out there. I hope it succeeds. I like to see innovation like this, and maybe something will come along that will work. I wonder about what if I mean, e-ink eventually is getting more and more paper-like. So someday, mm-hmm. on an infinite timescale, theoretically, we could all own one book-like object that looks like a book with paper, but the pages are actually e-ink, so that when you fire it up, it turns into whatever book you want to read, and then you annotate it like a book, and then you could flip through it, and then I'd toggle from Candy House to Sea of Tranquility to something else. Mm-hmm. Maybe that would be a thing. That's, you know, infinite timescales. That's a big ask, Rebecca. I realize that, but let's get on that, folks.
It is
let's
a big ask. Well, you know, I think we're kind of close to it. Like, I read all of my galleys in the Kindle app on my iPad, mm-hmm. because if you do that, they never expire. And like, that is the reason that I read them in that app. Don't at me with your Amazon feelings. Yeah. And if you highlight stuff as you're reading an ebook, which I will do occasionally if I'm reading something that's like, oh, it turns out I wish that I had been reading this in print, but here we are. I'm reading it digitally. Mm-hmm. Let me highlight some things. You can visit a menu that just shows you all of the highlights and you can jump to them, which kind of creates the feeling of paging through a book to see what you've marked. If you could do that and access your annotations at the same time.
Yeah,
that would get pretty close. Mm-hmm. But that is only available on like EPUB PDF things is a big non-starter.
Yeah,
for what we do. Yeah,
for what we would do with it. Yeah, would need some kind of way to mess with the DRM file. And once you do that, it's a real
mess. Yeah, I think that tells me that this is not for readers. Like, this is not about reading and annotating books.
No. Yeah, but maybe if you're a muckety muck at a law firm and you're reading your junior whoever's draft of something, you can get through it quickly, you know, strike a bunch of stuff out, lay some expletives at them, and send them on their merry way in a way that's, you know, maybe easier than sitting down with a laptop. Could be. Could very much be. I don't know why it's better than. I mean, there is a truth, though, that the e-ink experience, I've played around with some, I think they're called Wacom tablets, W-A-C-O-M, maybe it's Wacom, I don't know, that are for artists explicitly. And it does feel more tactile than even the really good Apple Pencil 2 on an iPad. You know, glass is just different than some of these more matte paper-like finishes. So if you're doing a lot of like digital writing, maybe if you're doing so much, just the tactile experience feels better. That I could understand. If you're doing a whole ton of it, might be a little bit better. Okay, Pulitzer Prizes. Boy, Rebecca, I haven't read any of these.
Thing or not a thing?
The Pulitzers are a thing. This is one of those years. Some years we look at these and like, wow, PRH, 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 yeah. Right? This is not one of the years. So fiction, probably many of you have seen this already. The Netanyahu's by Joshua Cohen, which I read about in Publishers Weekly, and it got a really good review there. Like, that's interesting. I'm not sure. I don't tend to like near historical fiction of famous people. Not my thing. I'm not sure. But it sounds like it was great. But I think the notable thing for me is NYRB, the New York Review of Books. Wow, big look for them.
Yeah.
Monkey Boy by Francisco Goldman was the finalist. So the Netanyahu's won. And then Palmares by Gail Jones, which I have on my shelf. I haven't gotten around to it yet. I was very excited. Been a long time since Gail Jones had a book out. Corregidora sort of maybe changed my reading mind in a lot of ways. It just blew my reading mind, not changed it, back when I read it. So I'm excited to see her there. I get some sales, some people to know Gail Jones. I'm not sure what to say. I think, you know, my interesting thing for me is there was only like 5,000 in print for the Netanyahu's.
Yeah.
So everyone's going to run and look for it to get some more. Good luck finding one for the Netanyahu's.
I know. I thought about calling a bookseller friend and being like, how hard is this for you right now? These books.
It reminds me of when Gurnow won the Nobel Prize and there's like literally nothing in print in America for Gurnow's book. And now you go to Powell's, you can see a whole bunch of them. But it's like this week is when people would be buying it.
Yeah.
That's too bad to see.
I will have to like familiarize myself. Is the Pulitzer's just the calendar year or do they have weird? Do you know? Do they have weird?
I believe
dates?
It's the calendar year.
Okay.
It's the calendar year.
Then I haven't read the Netanyahu's. I did hear good things. I'm sure that it's good and deserving. I have my personal bias, I guess, is like in a year where there's an Ishiguro
I don't know what we have to do for Clara and the Sun.
Right?
Like, I don't know.
That's. Yeah, not to take away from any of these books that I'm sure deserve to be here. And there's more than three books that deserve all of this attention in any given year. But this feels like an unusual selection. And I do think you're right that the Pulitzers are the weirdest of these because of the committee in a committee
yes.
nature of them. the conversations must be fascinating, how they arrive at these. And the fact that we continue, like, each year, there's usually, like, one or two that we've read, a couple that we haven't read, maybe something that we haven't heard of. And this is one of the years where it's, like, very, very outside of familiarity. And it was 2021 was, like, just an interesting publishing year, an interesting reading year. There wasn't a, like, monolithic success of, like, big book of 2021. No. Big work of fiction, at least. And I do think that those kinds of years lend themselves to, or they lead to, really interesting conversations if there's not one really clear standout. And, like, in my mind, Clara and the Sun is the really clear standout, but we didn't agree on that as a reading public. When the reading public has not agreed on the big thing, it's fascinating to see what other microcultures inside this big machine land on as the notable books. And having looked at these, you know, I don't think the fiction picks speak to, like, any sort of unified concern of the committee. Sometimes you can draw themes, or you can see, like, oh, they're really paying attention to, like, race issues this year. They're really paying attention to this particular thing. Small presses is really interesting.
Good for them.
Yeah.
I did a quick look. I knew the Pulitzers were coming out, so I did a quick jot down of, like, what titles might you see? Like, what would I expect to see, or what would my guesses be? And I didn't do the whole, like, you know, Vicini and Wesley over the wine stuff of, like, well, that's what they think, and they go the other way, and the Pulitzers like to zag, so I'm going to zig for my zag. But I had Clara in the Sun. I thought other ones that I've read that I thought were good enough and also felt like Pulitzer books. I thought we might see Love Songs of W.B. Du Bois. You know, that one was talked about a lot. I thought we might see Detransition Baby. I thought we might see Cloud Cuckoo Land was a little too literary, big. I didn't think that was going to be right, but that one's a lot of people who read books like this like to see. I wondered about After Parties, the Anthony Viazna So. I wondered about The Great Circle. So there were books, but none of them I was like, I don't know. My Monticello. I don't think that wasn't as well reviewed as I thought it might have been at the beginning.
I paused about Colson just looking Whitehead, but that was
that Harlem, was that last year?
Yeah, it was the fall.
It was last year, the fall. Yeah.
And again, and Jonathan Franzen and Louise Erdrich. Wait, now I'm getting mad.
Yeah, the sentence. I mean, there were books. That's what I'm saying. I'm getting to.
Yeah.
So there wasn't a standout winner, but there was a lot of these. But also remember, the Pulitzer is, I think, if I remember correctly, there's a standing Pulitzer board, and then for each of the categories, they do, like, a small subcommittee that recommends to the full thing. So it's like three or four people reading 50, 100 books, or the starts of them, or I don't even know, maybe a couple hundred. Yeah. I don't remember how many they're actually. They're probably given a bunch. Now, what would they do with them probably varies from year to year and person to person. But it's a small enough cohort that some randomness is possible.
Sure. Right?
You're not looking to get, like, the NBCC or something like that, where you have dozens or hundreds of book critics filling in ballots. Or like the NBA MVP, where having a whole bunch of people and the consensus really builds. Though I think with Clara and the Sun, the only thing I might say there, I do think there is the dude just won a Nobel. I mean, within the last few years. And if you get the right kind of committee makeup, you really might think of spotlighting. Like, am I really trying to do, like, crown the best for eternity? Or am I doing I really want to highlight this particular one, and it might be just as good, but I'm not as interested in so much as, like, picking from the 20, 25 books that River had put out last year or something like that, which some years feels like that.
That's, I think, those are always the biggest questions that I have, especially about the Pulitzers, is that they annotate the winners with, like, a one paragraph summary, or, like, it's like one sentence, you know, like, the one sentence about the Netanyahus is a mordant, linguistically deft historical novel about the ambiguities of the Jewish American experience, presenting ideas and disputes as volatile as it is tightly wound plot. Okay. But, like, talk to me about how that won. That's the most interesting thing. Like, how did you arrive at this is the thing we want to shine the spotlight on? Because that is the impact. You know, like, it might not bump this book or any winner into selling bajillions of copies, but it does. The Pulitzer and the NBA are big enough that people are calling their local bookstores this week and their Barnes and Nobles, and they're, you know, Googling it on Amazon of wanting to read this. It does boost things, and it raises your profile. And I would bet, I agree with you that some of the function of these committees, maybe that conversation is about where do we want to shine a light on books that are worthy and that have not gotten attention. But I would like them, I'd like to hear them even talk about that. You know, like, did they think about the fact that these are three books from small presses? Had they arrived at like a list of five or six that they thought were all equally good and they chose the three from the small press? Like, there's so many ways it could have gone. Maybe they didn't think about that at all and they just thought these were the three best and that was the conversation too. But like, I think you can talk, I would love it if they would talk to readers about how they arrive at these decisions. And I think that helps us decide what to read. Like, you know, I don't anymore in my reading life read something just because it won a particular award. You know, like even when you know a lot about how these awards function, unless it's like you and I are going to read the things that won the awards because we're going to talk about them on the show. But the like this won the Pulitzer, so I must go read it is not a thing for me. But if it was this won the Pulitzer and here's what they said about it and how they arrived at it, that would help me make a decision. And I think that's ultimately a better kind of service to these books if spotlighting is some of the work that they're doing here.
You know, the other thing is you would think I would be more excited about the reading, like the language of the Pulitzer citation. Like this is a prize about writing, especially.
Yes.
And listen to the words. And I don't want to be like close F.R. Leavis close reading, but here I go anyway, I guess. A mordant, linguistically deft historical novel. Mordant is like droll. Like that's not, mordant is the most boring, nice thing you can say about something.
And it sounds like a word for deft.
And also deft. Yeah. And deft is like fancy guys clever. Which is not that great. I mean, I don't think of that as so it's mordant about the ambiguities of the Jewish American experience. So it's mordant and deft about ambiguities. I'm asleep already. What is that about? And then comma, presenting ideas in disputes. Well, I should hope it presents some ideas. That's the least compelling like pitch for this. Like just the length. But here, then I'm going to go down to the history. One, there's two winners. Cover of the Night by Nicole Eustace, a gripping account. That's amazing.
Yes.
The first sentence of the Cuba one, an original and compelling history. That's for drama, a funny, poignant play. Also deft. We got to have a moratorium on deft. I'm sorry, Pulitzer Committee. You got to command F deft or control F deft and replace it with something else. We can't do deft anymore. Anyone who's getting a book published by a major house right now this kind of world, they're all of these can be deft. Deft is table stakes for this stuff. We got to be better than deft.
Was it Kakutani who always said limb?
Liminal. Yeah. Liminal. Yeah. You gotta limb your deafness here. I don't know what to say. I'm not excited about this book. And the semicolon suggests this reminds me of like a 90s subtitle, an account of a minor and ultimately even negligible history in the history of a very famous family. It has a little bit of heartbreaking work of staggering genius, self-aware vibes to it, which isn't bad necessarily. I just don't know. I'm sure it's great. I will read this because I will read anything that won the Pulitzer Prize because I'm one of those historical sticklers that wants to at least know what I don't like about the prize winners. I hope I'm wonderfully surprised, but it's going to take me a while to pick up because it's so mordant. You know, because I go to the bookstore, I'm like, you know what I'm looking for today? What do you got in mordancy, pals?
It does make you wonder about who got to write these slugs and what kind of instructions they
presenting
got.
Ideas the and history disputes? Presenting that's as neutral as it gets.
Yeah, the history ones do sound much more those write-ups sound much more exciting. It's just fascinating. I think I would love to hear the Pulitzer committees also talk about like, so you're working to recognize work that deserves recognition, you're spotlighting it for the public. Like, what is the function of that? Is it just to recognize the craft? Is it to help people who want to read books in some way determine the best use of their book time? Are they even thinking about that? Or is it solely an evaluation of like craft and literary import or cultural impact? Like as we know from looking back at many years of things, if we look at this list in 5 years, we are unlikely to remember any of these books. And that's true for almost any list of award winners or bestsellers at any point in time. So like given, okay, most things, this is now turning like maybe I'm becoming mordant. Like it's, I've forgotten what mordant means, but I might be becoming it. Like most books are going to be forgotten. Are we trying to mark these as memorable or are we just saying we think these are good works of art? I would be interested in that. Tell me what you're doing here.
Yeah, and it could be they just liked it the best.
Sure.
And for whatever reason, and this is what it is, and they were looking for some more dents. I'm looking for less dents, I guess, on the whole. I'd like to go in the other direction from this kind of citation. That having been said, I hope the book is wonderful. And I hope when I read it and when other people read it because of this, it's really eye-opening and like, yes, this should have been it. If you have read this, The Netanyahus, or Monkey Boy, or Palmares by Gail Jones, Monkey Boy by Francisco Goldman, and you have something to say about it, shoot us an email at podcast@bookriot.com. Yes, we can talk about it.
Yes, you know, I want to ask you to talk to me about Gail Jones, because I heard expanded your mind or exploded your mind, and I am unfamiliar.
So Gail, I'm going to Google real quick when Corregidora came out. Let's see. Corregidora came out in, I think, 74, 75, and it's set in Kentucky in, I think, just after World War II, and the main character is getting out of a hospital, and she's a blues singer, and you follow her through her recovery from the injury and her relationships, and it's into two sections that flash forwards when one of her boyfriends comes back, and it's this fragmented family history, but the real thing I think was about is it's about domestic and sexual violence and trauma and womanhood and motherhood is like way, way ahead of its time. Talking about stuff like you think of Beloved, right? 1989. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. This is 16 years before that. And it's even more experimental formally than Beloved. And much more, in a way, much more traumatizing. I know that's wild to say, but its own way it really is. And it's an experimental novel. And it's like the Odyssey for a black woman. Ulysses for a black woman blues singer, whose story is about sex, but from a violence point of view. I was not ready for it when I read it when I was 23. I'll tell you that right now. Boy. I'm still coming. But it's the kind of things like, I didn't know you could do this. Mm. In a lot of ways, I feel like contemporary writing is still, you know, I don't think it's as influential as it could be, but it casts a shadow artistically that you can see in other things that people are doing. In fact, I'll talk about a little bit in Frontless Foyer, something that reminded me of Corregidora just a little bit.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that also makes me think we should do an episode at some point about the books that blew our minds.
Oh, yeah. That's a cool idea. I don't remember. The new one came out, and I think it's pretty long, but it'd been 35 years since she wrote Corregidora.
Wow, okay.
I can't remember. It'd been a good long time, so it was too long. We were talking about doing an episode about the varieties of one-hit wonders, and Corregidora almost could have been one, but it's short. I'm sorry, it's short. Did I say long? I mean, it's really short, so it almost has like a Cain by Gene Toomer vibe. Mm-hmm. I think experimentally and formally, it reminds me most of that. If you want to buy a hardcover of Corregidora, first edition, do you have any idea what it's going to cost you? I'm just on Amazon right now. Try to remember.
I feel like it's either going to be depressingly low or shockingly high, but nowhere in between.
Yeah, that's you're on the right vibe.
a first edition hardcover.
Yeah, there's only two available on Amazon right now. If that gives you any hint,
$5,000.
Oh, that's lower than that. $901.
Oh, okay, good. Well, okay.
And a used in bad condition is $400.
I am unfamiliar with the specificities of used.
You mean a book and author you really knew nothing about? You didn't feel good guessing the value of a book
did
you
not.
Didn't know existed?
Nope.
Yeah, okay.
Your favorite Palmares, game, make me guess things.
Yeah, I know. Really, like, so Palmares, was this one? Do I remember this right? This is super long. I'm sorry. It's everyone's favorite game. Listen to someone scroll the internet on a podcast. I'm so sorry for this. 540 pages. Yeah, so it's really long. I can picture it on my bookshelves down south. Looking forward to that. I'm not sure. I'd never heard. I'm one thing I do like the Pulitzers for, especially, is they recognize drama, and they're always pretty interesting. This one's Fat Ham, a funny, poignant play that deftly transposes Hamlet to a family barbecue in the American South. I would watch this. Where can I get a ticket?
Yes, I will go to this in a heartbeat.
Yeah, by James E. James E. Yamas.
Yeah,
E. James.
Sure.
I don't know how to say the last name. I looked real quick. I'm sorry. I did do the very minimal effort to try to get that right. Biography Chasing Me to My Grave, an artist memoir of the Jim Crow South, by the late Winfred Rembert, as told to Aaron I. Kelly. So that's interesting. Bit of an oral history.
Yeah.
Sounds interesting. Poetry, Frank Sonnets by Diane Seuss from Grey Wolf. General nonfiction, Invisible Child, Poverty, Survival, and Hope in an American City. This one I had heard of, got a lot of good reviews. Mm-hmm. And I'm in the place with my nonfiction. I can't do tough hangs right now. Someday I'll come back around to it, but I don't have the stomach for this right now.
I feel you.
It's about homelessness in New York. I'm sure it's really important, and I'd learn a lot, and my life would be changed, and I would go out and sally forth into the world righting all wrongs, a la Man of La Mancha. But I don't have this. I don't have the spoons for it right now. I'm having the trouble.
Serious nonfiction spoons are hard to come by these days.
They really are. Anything else from finalists? Anything else you want to say?
No, I don't think so. Just I'm always surprised and pleasantly surprised to be reminded, I guess, of how many books there are that are good and worth talking about that we haven't even heard of. And like, I know that there are folks on the other side of it who find it, I don't know, like depressing or challenging that you're just never going to be able to read all of the things that you want to be able to read or all of the good things. But I love that. I love the like abundance of great material, and I think it shores up. It gives me some like spiritual shoring up against concerns about like contraction in the publishing industry or what will happen if more publishers merge together. Like that will be difficult, but we're not going to be short on reading material.
No, that's what I've always said. You know, as long as there are more books that I would like to read than I have time to read, I myself don't have a problem with whatever happens in publishing. Yeah. Like that's my litmus test. And some of it is I have a very wide reading interest level. Maybe there are people out there that don't get enough. I can't find enough what I like. I would sympathize with that. But for me, it's orders of magnitude bigger than I ever. There's a lot of these I'd get to, like the Sisters Blackwell about pioneering sister doctors. Totally in. A lot of interesting stuff that goes on here. Check it out. If you read any of these, have strong feelings one or the other. If we said something avoidably barbaric, let me know. I will, in the fullness of time, read the Netanyahu's. I also will read Palmera's. And if you have seen Fat Ham and you know where I can get a ticket,
yes, tell
let
us.
Me know. Yeah. All right, let's do another sponsor break and do Front List Foyer.
Today's episode is brought to you by W.W. Norton and Company Incorporated. So, Negative Space by Jillian Linden follows a week in the life of an English teacher at a New York private school. At home, her children ask constant questions about mortality, and her husband offers occasional counsel between Zoom calls. At school, something happens. She accidentally witnesses an ambiguous, possibly inappropriate interaction between a teacher and a student, but how can she be sure of what she saw? Negative Space is a portrait of a woman caught between the pressures of what's normal and what isn't, and examines what we owe the people who depend on us in a fractured and indifferent world. It's a debut novel and a short novel. It's perfect if you want something quick and easy to carry around, but it's also thought-provoking. It takes place during the pandemic, but it's not pandemic-focused, and it really just looks at everyday anxieties in low-threat situations that have high consequences. So make sure to check out Negative Space by Jillian Linden. And thanks again to W.W. Norton and Company Incorporated for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Children of Virtue and Vengeance by Tomi Adeyemi. If you like pretty things, like I like pretty things, I got something for you. The stunning sequel to the worldwide phenomenon Children of Blood and Bone is now available in a deluxe paperback edition with gorgeous spray-painted and stenciled edges and an exclusive excerpt of the earth-shaking Children of Anguish and Anarchy. Now, this is a series for you if you like action, you like world building, you like mythology retellings, lore retellings, specifically of a West African variety, has all that and more. It was also an instant number one New York Times bestseller, a Good Morning America book club pick, and now both Children of Bone and Children of Virtue and Vengeance are available in these deluxe editions. They're pretty, they're gorgeous. The finale to the series is coming June 25th this year, so you can get the pretty editions of the first two books and be ready for the last book. You see what I'm saying? So make sure to check it out, and thanks again to Children of Virtue and Vengeance by Tomi Adeyemi for sponsoring this episode.
All right. What do you want to talk about? I don't remember the last time I did this, so I'm going to be careful. I think the last time I had said I just finished Left on 10th.
Yes.
So I kind of know where I've read 7 or 8 things since then. Where do you want to go?
Let's see. Only one of the ones that I've read recently has already come out, so maybe I'll start there.
Okay, you'll go there.
It's called Open by Rachel Krantz. I don't have it in front of me, but the subtitle is something about memoir of an open relationship, something, something. And so it was presented as like the jacket copy is like, she has this unconventional kind of relationship. And then also she discovers that she's queer through that dynamic. It is a juicy memoir. It's a juicy hang. It's also really challenging. I just read it because I heard it was juicy. But if your ears perked up of like, oh, that's the kind of relationship I might be curious about exploring, I think reading this book as an exploration of how to have an open relationship would be akin to like reading 50 Shades of Grey as an exploration of how to have a BDSM kind of relationship. This is an abusive relationship. The dynamic is really unhealthy. She describes it graphically on the page. There is verbal abuse and sexual assault and a lot of ungood stuff. Ungood, whether your relationship is open or closed, but the like that open dynamic is kind of part of the abuse that this man applies to her, that it takes her a really long time to recognize is abusive and not just part of like a kink dynamic, because she's unfamiliar with any of this stuff. So it was juicy, but also I felt very cringy and like, where are your friends? I don't know. So if you're like in the market for a juicy memoir, it was not a bad read. It like read very fast. I read it on vacation. But I feel like the, I don't know, positioning of it could be doing readers a disservice. Like it's kind of not, it's not really what it says it is on the box. But it was juicy and interesting. And then on the things I've read that haven't come out yet, probably the most exciting one is the new Celeste Ng called Our Missing Hearts.
Yeah, you told me about this.
Yeah, that comes out this fall. I don't want to say too much about it because it's like, it's wonderful. And it's Celeste Ng goes a little spec fic. It's set in some sort of like slight future. We don't know the exact year. Something has happened called the crisis in American culture that sounds like a giant economic crash that had something to do with China. And so legislation has been passed that outlaws any sort of like affiliation with China, any sort of advocacy or positive public statement about China. It's kind of in the vein of like a communist scare sort of thing. Like neighbors are spying on neighbors and turning them in for things. Kids get taken from their parents if their parents are suspected of being Chinese sympathizers. And wrapped up in sort of all of this culture is that people of all sorts of Asian descent are victims of all kinds of violence and oppression and marginalization on top of what they experience like now in the real world. Because of what's happened in this world that she imagines. And the main character is a kid whose mother is connected to a movement trying to reunite children who have been separated or taken from their parents because of this stuff. I got into like the first five pages and she just kind of drops you into the world and starts talking about these things. And I was like, whoa, I'm not in suburban Boston. Like we're in Celeste Ng spec fic with like full politics in a way I really loved. I loved seeing her do it. I think it's like the right time in her career. I don't know how much of it was plotted out of like, I'm going to do a couple big, juicy, great book club novels that address racism and talk about some of these things, but in a way that's like palatable to book club readers or, you know, a wide reading public. I do not say book club readers pejoratively. And then like she's positioned to do a thing like this and have a lot of people pick up a book with her name on it and then get to the ideas that she's pushing, the challenges she's issuing to the reader, the stuff she wants to make you face. I'm into it. I was here for it.
That's awesome. I'm really looking forward to that. And she's had two commercial successes. Yep. She's had the Hulu show, probably the other one's been in development. I don't really know where it's been. I'm sure everything's adapted now for anything moderately popular. It's also been a few years, so there's a coiled spring of the last 5 to 6 years of politics that I'm sure Celeste was on a guest on Reading Lies. I got to know her a little bit there, and she has opinions and feelings and ideas, and I'm not surprised. I guess I'm pleasantly surprised but not shocked to see that she's, I guess, using some of her chips mm-hmm. in this particular kind of way.
I think it's really, really smart, looking forward really to that. Interesting.
Yeah. I dropped a link into this. I dropped a link to the book I'm going to talk about for a minute because I want you to see the cover.
Oh,
because
okay.
I think the cover is important here because it's kind of how I got into it a little bit. I saw a review for it in Publishers Weekly, and I was like, that sounds interesting. Then I was in Powell's, and I saw the cover, and it struck me for a couple of reasons that might be interesting. It is the polar opposite of the flowered Instagram cover. I was thinking explicit. No, I was thinking explicitly about somebody's daughter, Rebecca, and I'm serious about this.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? Because that's a very tough book.
Yes.
But the cover is looks like it could be your MacBook wallpaper,
mm-hmm.
right? You know? Or, you know, a 90s skirt kind of a situation. So this is Post-Traumatic by Chantel Johnson. She's a debut novelist. I haven't felt about this book. I haven't felt a way about a book that I felt about this book in a long time where it took me a place I didn't know I needed to go. And also, it's like, why haven't someone done this? And maybe they haven't ever read it before. She's a debut novelist. So the cover is... Podcasting is a theater of the mind. So on the cover, in very stark Helvetica, it says post-traumatic in the corner, bent in the corner at the hyphen. And on the left-hand side, you see a mixed-race woman, darker-skinned mixed-race woman, in her bathrobe, sitting on the corner of a bath, looking at herself in the mirror, smoking a cigarette. Yeah. It's unattractive.
Margot Tenenbaum vibe.
It's a Margot Tenenbaum vibe, but made not as quirky. You're not like, boy, this is going to be a quirky read. It's like, is this woman okay?
Yeah,
that's right. The vibe.
Yeah,
you're
that is
from.
The vibe.
And the answer is she is not okay. The main character, Vivian, Chantel Johnson was a social worker, a social lawyer, a lawyer that worked in mental hospitals. And that's what the main character's job is. Her name is Vivian. So there's an element of autofiction here, though. I think it can't possibly be the case that they're that close, but I think she's using her experience to tell a story. To me, I don't know really how to describe this book. If I were to be very, very bombastic, I would say it feels like it could be the Catcher of the Rye of our moment in this regard, which it is taking a particular sensibility, a particular experience, and really diving into it. This is a Black Latinx woman who is a professional. She went to Harvard. She's doing the good thing. She's out there fighting for people who are being incarcerated for mental illness. The opening scene finds her trying to calm down someone wielding a knife at her in Bellevue in New York. But she's also has sexual violence in her own history. She has her own hangups. Her family is horribly toxic and unhelpful. She's trying to date. She's got hangups. She's a mess. She's smart. She's witty. She both knows what she's supposed to think, and then she also knows what she's actually thinking in the moment and how those two things are different, and you see her working that out. There's a couple of particular moments as set pieces I found especially astonishing. One is she's just on a train, a subway, looking around like if you've lived in New York or you've been in New York for a while, you know you do this, where you see like a little unit of people and you start observing them, like what's going on with that family, that couple. And this is a Black family, and they're doing some stuff with each other, and I'll leave it at that. And she's looking at them, and then judging them, and then judging her judging of them, and then thinking about what she's doing. And it does express the sort of like metacognition that people have to do, both as marginalized people, as traumatized people, but then as people who feel things differently than they want to be. And I think that describes a lot of us.
Mm-hmm.
And how she captures that, I found completely stunning. I read it in one day, has a surprising ending. This is not easy. I'm sure there are people out there who will find it troubling, not just because of what's depicted, but the manner of the depiction, because it's not easy. It doesn't pull any punches. I can't speak highly enough of it. If there's any justice in the world, a bunch of people will read this book and we'll see it. We'll see more books from her, and this will be marked as a seminal work. Maybe I'm wrong. I've seen no one talking about it. It has 12 ratings on Amazon. I don't know what to say about that. So please, if you're at all interested, give it a shot. Go try a sample. I don't know. I don't want to tell people to go buy, but please try it. I would like to try it. And if you hate it, great, Rebecca, let's talk about it. If you love it, let's talk about it. If you have read this book and you hate it, please email me. I just want to get a little, anything that we can in our little circle to see if there's a thing here for people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, man. I don't talk about books
no,
like this, so I'm not sure what else to say.
For you. Yeah.
And I'm not a Black person. I'm not a Latinx person. So I'm coming from my own point of view. I haven't read any criticism of it outside a good review in Publishers Weekly, which tends to be pretty anodyne. You know, they're not very political. But wow, I don't know, man. I think it was an amazing book. It's a portrait. A portrait of a person.
I can really hear that. This is as close as you get to verbal exclamation points.
Yeah, it really is. It's stunning. I thought it was completely stunning. So if I had Reading Lives or any format, I'd get Chantal or Ms. Johnson or however she'd like to, I'll refer to however she likes to be referred, to talk about this, because it's a really fascinating book. And I don't know, I mean, it's not like a small press. I think it's Little Brown.
Yeah.
It made some lists, you know, Vulture's most anticipated books, maybe Oprah's best books of springs. But for some reason, maybe people, just like I don't want to read whatever that book about nonfiction people in New York having a hard time, for some reason, this is okay for me. I don't know. I'm complicated. Whatever.
Marketing budgets are not bountiful for debut novels about really tough stuff.
Yeah. It also tells you that it's not selling very well when the Amazon discount for the hardcover is 9%.
Oh, boy.
So go buy it locally. Don't go buy it. That's what I did. I actually did look. I was like, could I save $10? No, I cannot. So I bought it at Powell's, and they got my marginal dollar there. A new kind of survivor narrative. That's what it's. That's one of the things. I'm not sure that's right. I kind of would like another crack at the marketing copy. I'm sure they know what they're doing. It's not wrong, but...
Interesting.
Anyway, interesting. Well, I'll be curious to see.
Speaking of another crack at the marketing copy, I don't want to come off of a great recommendation and do a like middling thing.
Right.
But I read Dinner for One by Sutanya Dukres.
Okay.
That we can spoil for people.
I was excited about.
Yeah.
Okay,
is a pick from your, this is a little spoiler from folks who aren't in our Patreon. It's one of your picks for the summer draft, and is like ostensibly a memoir about a woman who has moved to Paris with her husband. They break up and learning to cook for herself. It's Dinner for One, How Cooking in Paris Saved Me. And I was like mad that you heard of this book and got to pick it before I did, because this is right up our shared alley. And I got the galley. I read it on a trip a couple of weeks ago. It's like it's a good memoir. It's a fine memoir. But the breakup doesn't happen until like 52% into the book. And she cooks like four meals.
Come on. So it's mostly not dinner for two.
Right. So it's mostly like, and I think with different packaging, I probably still would have read this. Mm. Like she meets this man. They have this sort of whirlwind, long distance relationship. They don't know each other very well because whirlwind and long distance. And she moves to Paris. They get married and are all of a sudden living together. And all of a sudden living together as married people when the 3 years of your relationship prior have just been long distance of like only long weekends with each other where everything feels like a honeymoon period. But like now you live with this person and you see all of them and they see all of you. That's a big jump. And it's challenging for them and it does not go well. And she writes like, I think really intentionally and intelligently and openly about how that does not go well. Like she's coming from a mature place of being able to reflect on that relationship. Mm. And she is kind of a disaster when it doesn't go well. Is drinking a lot, not making healthy choices. And like one day sort of is like, I'm going to get my stuff together. And like, I'm going to learn to roast a chicken. You know, and listen, if anybody believes in the soul healing power of roasting a chicken, it's me.
Yeah, you do.
And it's a beautiful passage when she writes about it. And then she writes about like a dinner party that she cooks for friends that is a failure, but she learns some things and some of the other dishes. So the last, I was reading digitally, so I couldn't like flip through and see the setup of the book. So the breakup happens at the 50-ish% mark of the book's total. And then you only get 20% more book of writing. The last chunk is recipes. So it was like, of the action that's happening, the breakup really happens about 75% through the action. And I was just like, this is just not how this should have been packaged. This is not a book about learning to cook for yourself and how it saved you. It's a book about other kinds of things and relationships and coming of age. And, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. Market. I mean, it's not quite my funny farm experience, but I can see
it's
where
not.
You're coming from.
Yeah.
You were looking for a little bit maybe From Scratch by Tembi Locke, but not quite so dour. I mean, that's kind of what I was looking for.
Yeah, I think
honestly.
somewhere in the vein of From Scratch and like early Ruth Reichel. And that's, wasn't what I got. It's not bad, just not what I was expecting.
Just not what you wanted. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's our show. Maybe we'll do a... if we do talk about post-traumatic, we're doing on the main feed because I want people to have to listen to us or decide actively not to listen to us. And I hope I'm right. It's, you know, I don't go on a limb like this. So now I'm nervously twisting my podcast cord around my finger because I've gone on an aesthetic judgmental limb here, which I don't like to do.
Do you want me to send you all caps texts as soon as I start it if it's good?
I don't know. I don't know what I want. That's our show. You can find links to what we talked about this week in all episodes of the Back Book Riot podcast, bookriot.com/listen. You can shoot us the email at podcast@bookriot.com. You can go check out our Patreon at patreon.com/bookriotpodcast. And Rebecca and I are going to do a quick break and then stop this feed and then record some discussion about Sea of Tranquility that you can only listen to over there. Rebecca, I'll talk to you in literally 2 minutes.
Okay.